My thoughts exactly, I reply. It's a strange thing to be in an airport and to not be celebrating a reunion or a departure. It's even stranger to sit in the back seat of Henry's car and listen to him making small talk with Theo, as if Theo isn't smart enough to know that, at some point, a colossal bomb is going to drop. When Theo went into the restroom at the airport, Henry came up with a plan. "Let me talk to him," Henry said. "He won't listen to you." "Well, he ran away from you," Henry pointed out. The freeways here are white as bone and clean. There's no cracking from frost heaves, like in Vermont. Shiny and happy and new. No wonder Henry likes it. "Theo," I say, "what were you thinking?" He twists in his seat.
"I wanted to talk to Dad."
In the rearview mirror, Henry meets my gaze. "I told you so." "Haven't you ever heard of a phone?" But before he can answer, Henry pulls into a driveway. His house has Spanish tiles on its roof and a plastic, child-sized princess castle on the front lawn. That makes my chest tighten. Meg, Henry's new wife, bursts out the front door. "Oh, thank goodness," she says, clasping her hands together when she sees Theo in the front seat. She's a tiny blonde with uber-white teeth and a shiny ponytail. Henry approaches her, leaving me to wrestle my own bag out of the trunk. Standing beside each other, with their blue eyes and golden hair, they look like a poster for the quintessential Aryan family. "Theo," Henry says, all fatherly, too little too late, "let's go into the library and talk a little." I want to hate Meg, but I can't. She immediately surprises me by linking her arm through mine and leading me into the house. "You must have been worried sick," she says. "I know I would have been." She offers me coffee and a slice of lemon poppy seed cake while Theo and Henry vanish deeper into the house. I wonder if the cake was just lying around, if she's the sort of mother who makes sure there's a homemade baked good at all times on the kitchen counter, or if she'd popped it in the oven after Henry told her I was coming. I'm not quite sure which image upsets me more. Her daughters, well, Henry's too, dart across the living room threshold to get a peek at me. They're sprites, little toe-headed fairies. One of them wears a pink sequined tutu. "Girls," Meg says, "come on in here and meet Ms. Hunt." "Emma," I say automatically. I wonder what these little girls make of a stranger who has the same last name they do. I wonder if Henry's ever explained me to them. "This is Isabella," Meg says, lightly touching the taller girl on the crown of her head. "And this is Grace." "Hello," they chime, and Grace pops her thumb in her mouth. "Hi," I answer, and then I don't know what to say. Did Henry feel there was some balance to his second life, having two girls instead of two boys? Grace tugs on her mother's shirt and whispers in her ear. "She wants to show you what she does in ballet," Meg says apologetically. "Oh, I love ballet," I say. Grace puts her arms in the air and touches her fingertips together. She begins to turn in a circle, wobbling only a little. I clap for her. Jacob used to spin. It was one of his stims when he was little. He'd go faster and faster until he crashed into something, usually a vase or another breakable item. I already know it's not true by looking at her. But if little Grace turned out to be autistic, would Henry run away again? As if I've conjured him, Henry ducks into the room.
"You were right," he says to me. "He won't talk without you there."
Whatever small satisfaction this gives me vanishes as Grace sees her father. She stops spinning and hurls himself at him with the force of a tropical storm. He lifts her into his arms and then tousles Isabella's hair. There's an ease to Henry that I haven't seen in him before. A quiet confidence that this is where he belongs. I can see it etched on his face, in the tiny lines that now fan out from his eyes. Lines that were not there when I loved him. Meg takes Grace on her hip and grasps Isabella's hand. "Let's give Daddy a chance to talk to his friends," she says. Friends. I loved him. I created children with him. And this is what we've been demoted to. I follow Henry down a corridor to the room where Theo is waiting. "Your family," I say. "They're perfect." But what I'm really saying is, why didn't I deserve this with you?
Oliver. "Well, Mr. Bond," the judge says, "here you are again." "Like a bad penny," I reply, smiling. Jacob and I are in court again, this time without Emma. She had called late last night and left a message saying that she and Theo would be flying home today. I hoped to have good news for her when she arrived. God knows she would need some by then. The judge glances over the half moons of his glasses. "We've got a motion before the court for accommodations during the trial of Jacob Hunt. What are you looking for, counselor?" Sympathy for a client who is incapable of showing any himself, but I can't admit that. After Jacob's last outburst in court, I thought about asking the judge to let him watch the proceedings from a separate room, but I need him in full view of the jury in order to make my defense work. If I'm playing the disability card, they have to be able to see Asperger's manifesting itself in its full glory. "First, Your Honor," I say, "Jacob needs sensory breaks. You've seen how he can get agitated by courtroom procedure. He has to be able to get up and leave the courtroom when he feels the need to do so. Second, he would like to have his mother sitting at the defense table beside him. Third, due to Jacob's sensitivity to stimuli, we ask that Your Honor not use his gavel during the proceedings, and that the lights be turned down in the courtroom. Fourth, the prosecution needs to ask questions in a very direct and literal manner." "For God's sake," Helen Sharp sighs. I glance at her, but keep talking. "Fifth, we request that the length of the day in court be abbreviated." The judge shakes his head. "Miss Sharp, I'm quite sure you have objections to those requests." "Yes, Your Honor. I don't have a problem with numbers 1, 3, and 5, but the others are absolutely prejudicial." "Mr. Bond," the judge says, "why are you asking for your client's mother to sit at counsel table?" "Well, Your Honor, you've seen Jacob's outbursts. Emma Hunt serves as a coping mechanism for him. I think that, given the stress of a court experience, having his mother beside him would be beneficial to all involved." "And yet Miss Hunt is not with us today," the judge points out. "But the defendant seems to be faring well." "Ms. Hunt wanted to be here, but there has been a family emergency," I say. "And in terms of stress, there's a huge difference between coming to court for a motion and coming for a full-blown murder trial." "Ms. Sharp," the judge asks, "what is the basis for your objection to having the defendant's mother sit at counsel table?" "It's twofold, Your Honor. There's a concern about how to explain to the jury the defendant's mother's presence there. She's testifying as a witness, so she will clearly be identified as the defendant's mother, and as the court well knows, it is not good protocol to allow anyone other than the attorney and clients to sit at counsel table. Giving her the elevated position at table awards her more importance in the eyes of the jury, and it becomes an unexplained incident that negatively impacts the state. Moreover, we've heard all too often that the defendant's mother interprets for him. She intervenes at his school with teachers, with strangers, with police officers. She's the one who burst into the station and told the detective she had to be present at the interrogation.
Judge, what's to prevent her from writing an entire script for Jacob and passing it to him or whispering in his ear during the course of the trial to coach him into saying or doing something inappropriate and prejudicial? I stare at her for a moment. She's really good. Mr. Bond, how do you respond? The judge asks. Judge, Jacob's mother's presence at counsel table is the equivalent of having a seeing eye dog for a defendant who's blind. The jury will understand, if told, that it's not just an animal in the courtroom, it's a necessity, an accommodation being made for the defendant because of his disability. Jacob's mother and her proximity to him during the trial can be explained the same way, I say. What you're ruling on today, Judge, is what accommodations need to be made to ensure that my client has a fair trial. That right, and those accommodations, are assured to him pursuant to the Americans with Disabilities Act and, even more important, pursuant to the Fifth, Sixth, and Seventh Amendments of the United States Constitution. Does this mean giving Jacob some minor concessions that other defendants don't get in court? Yes, because those other defendants don't have to deal with the crippling inability to communicate effectively and to interact with other people like Jacob does. For them, a trial is not a gigantic mountain standing between them and freedom, without even having the most basic tools with which they can begin climbing. I glance surreptitiously at the judge and make the snap decision to tone it down a little. So how do we explain Jacob's mother's position to the jury? Easy. We say that the judge has given her a right to sit at counsel table. We say that this isn't usual practice, but in this case, she has a right to sit there. As for her role in the trial, Your Honor, I will have her agree not to speak to Jacob, but instead to communicate with him via writing. And those notes can be turned into the court at the close of the day or during each recess so that Ms. Sharp gets to see exactly what dialogue is going on between them. The judge removes his glasses and rubs the bridge of his nose. This is an unusual case with unusual circumstances. I've certainly had a good number of defendants come in front of me who had a hard time communicating. But in this case, we have a young man facing very serious charges and possible incarceration for the rest of his life. And we know he has a diagnosed inability to communicate the way the rest of us do. So it would be an oversight to expect him to behave in a courtroom the way the rest of us would. He looks at Jacob, who, I imagine, is still not meeting his gaze. What a fair trial looks like for this defendant may well be different from what it looks like for others. But that's the nature of America. We make room for everyone. And that's what we're going to do for Mr. Hunt. He looks down at the motion before him. All right. I'm going to allow for the sensory breaks. We will ask the bailiff to set up a special room at the back of the courtroom, and any time the defendant feels the need to leave, he is to pass a note to you, Mr. Bond. Is that satisfactory? Yes, I say. Then, counselor, you may approach and ask me to call for a recess. You will explain to your client that he may not leave the courtroom until the recess has been called and he's been excused by the court. Got it, Your Honor, I reply. As for your third request, I will not use my gavel for the duration of this trial. However, I'm not going to turn down the lights. It's a security hazard for the bailiffs. Hopefully having sensory breaks will help compensate, and I have no objection to the defendant turning out the lights in the break room in the rear of the court. Jacob tugs on my coat. Can I wear sunglasses? No, I say curtly. Third, I'll shorten the court sessions. We will break the trial into 3 45-minute sessions in the morning, 2 in the afternoon, with 15-minute breaks in between. We will adjourn at 4 p.m. every day. I assume that will be satisfactory, Mr. Bond? Yes, Your Honor. I agree to allow the defendant's mother to sit at counsel table, however, they can only communicate in writing, and those notes must be turned into the court at every break. Finally, in regard to your request for the prosecution's questioning to be direct and simple, the judge says, that I will deny. You can ask whatever short, literal questions you like, Mr. Bond, but the defendant has no constitutional right to direct how the state chooses to present its case. He sticks my motion back inside a folder. I trust that's all satisfactory, Mr. Bond. Of course, I say, but inside I'm doing handsprings, because all of these little quirks and concessions are greater than the sum of their parts. The jury cannot help but see that Jacob's different from your average defendant. from the rest of us and should be judged accordingly.
Theo. I wake up sneezing. When I open my eyes, I'm in a pink room and there are feathers tickling my nose. I jackknife upright in the narrow little bed and remember where I am. One of the girls' rooms. There are mobiles with glittery stars and piles of stuffed animals and a pink camouflage rug. I sneeze again. And that's when I realize I'm wearing a pink feather boa. What the fuck? I say, unspooling it from my neck, and then I hear giggling. I lean over the side of the bed and find my father's younger kid, I think her name is Grace, hiding under the bed.
You said a bad word, she tells me.
What are you doing here?
What are you doing here? She asks.
This is my room. I flop back down on the mattress. Between the time my flight arrived and the talk, I probably got all of 4 hours of sleep. No wonder I feel like shit. She slips out from underneath the bed and sits down beside me. She's really little. I'm not good with kid ages, though. She has purple nail polish on her toes and she's wearing a plastic tiara. How come you're not in school?
Because it's Friday, silly, Grace says, although this doesn't make any sense to me.
You have really big feet. They're bigger than Leon. I'm wondering who Leon is, but then she takes a stuffed pig and holds it up against the bare sole of my foot. My watch is on the nightstand, next to a book about a mouse too shy to tell anyone her name. I read it last night before I went to bed. It's only 6:42 a.m., but we're leaving early. We've got a plane to catch.
Are you my brother?
Grace asks. I look at her. I try really hard, but I can't see a single feature we have in common. And that's really weird because my mom has always told me I remind her of my dad. For the record, now that I've seen for myself, it's not true. I'm just blonde, that's all, and everyone else in my household has dark hair. I guess you could say that, I tell her.
Then how come you don't live here?
I look around at the princess poster on the wall, the China tea set on a table in the corner. I don't know, I say, when the real answer is, because you have another brother, too. This is what happened last night. I got off the plane and found my parents, both of them, waiting for me outside airport security. What the hell? I blurted out.
My thoughts exactly, Theo, my mother said curtly, and then before she could tear me a new one,
my father said we were going to his house to discuss this. He made stupid conversation for the 20-minute drive while I felt my mother's eyes boring holes into the back of my skull. When we reached his home, I got a glimpse of a real pretty woman who had to be his wife before he led me into the library. It was very modern and totally unlike our house. There were windows that made up one entire wall, and the couch was black leather and full of right angles. It looked like the kind of room you see in magazines at doctor's offices, and not anywhere you'd want to live. Our couch was made of some red stain-proof fabric, and yet there was a stain on the arm from where I spilled grape juice once. The zippers on two of the pillows were broken. But when you wanted to flop down and watch TV, it fit you perfectly. So, my father said, gesturing to a seat. This is a little awkward. Yeah. I mean, I don't really have much of a right to tell you that running away was a stupid thing to do, and that you scared your mother to death. And I'm not going to tell you that she's out for blood. You don't have to tell me that. He clasps his hands between his knees. Anyway, I've been thinking about it, and I'm not going to tell you any of those things. He looks at me. I figured you came all the way out here so that I would listen. I hesitate. He seems so familiar to me. But that's crazy, given that I talk to him twice a year, on Christmas and my birthday. And yet, maybe that's what being related to someone does for you. Maybe it lets you pick up where you left off, even if that was 15 years ago. I want to tell him why I'm there. The story of Jacob's arrest, the truth behind my own breaking and entering, the phone message I never gave my mother from the bank, denying her the second mortgage loan. But all the words jam in my throat. I choke on the sentences until I can't breathe, until tears spring to my eyes, and what comes out, finally, is none of these things. Why didn't I matter? I say. This isn't what I wanted. I wanted him to see me as the responsible young man I've become, trying to save my family, and I wanted him to shake his head and think, I sure fucked up. I should have stayed with him, gotten to know him. He turned out so well. Instead, I'm a blubbering mess, with my nose running and my hair in my eyes, and I'm so tired. I'm suddenly so freaking tired. When you expect something, you're sure to be disappointed. I learned that a long time ago. But if this had been my mother sitting next to me, her arms would have wrapped around me in an instant. She would have rubbed my back and told me to relax, and I would have let myself melt against her until I felt better. My father cleared his throat and didn't touch me at all. I'm not very good at this kind of thing, he said. He shifted, and I wiped my eyes, thinking he was trying to reach out to me, but instead he took his wallet out of his back pocket. Here, he says, holding out a few 20s. Why don't you take this? I look at him, and before I know it, a laugh has snorted its way out of me. My brother is about to be tried for murder. My mother wants my head on a silver platter. My future's so dim I might as well be buried in a coal mine. And my father can't even pat me on the back and tell me I'm going to be okay. Instead, he thinks $60 is going to make everything better. I'm sorry, I say, laughing in earnest now. I'm really sorry. It strikes me that I'm not the one who should be saying that. I don't know what I was thinking, coming out here. There are no silver bullets in life. There's just the long, messy climb out of the pit you've dug yourself. I think maybe you should go get Mom, I say. I'm sure my father thinks I'm crazy, laughing my ass off like this when a minute before I was sobbing, and as he gets up, relieved to get the hell away from me, I'm sure, I realize why my father seems familiar. It's not because we have anything in common, much less share a genetic code. It's because, with his obvious discomfort and the way he won't look at me now and the fact that he doesn't want physical contact, he reminds me so much of my brother. I don't speak to my mom the whole time my father is driving us to the airport. I don't say a word when my father gives her a check and she looks at the number written on it and cannot speak. Just take it, he says. I wish I could be there for him. He doesn't mean it. What he really wishes is that he was capable of being there for Jacob. But my mother seems to understand this, and whatever money he's given her helps too. She gives him a quick goodbye hug. Me, I hold out my hand. I don't make the same mistake twice. We don't talk in the departure lounge, or as we're boarding, or during takeoff. It isn't until the pilot gets on the loudspeaker to mumble about our cruising altitude that I turn to my mother and tell her I'm sorry. She's flipping through an in-flight magazine. I know, she says. Really sorry. I'm sure, Like, about stealing your credit card number, and all of that. Which is why you're paying me back for these tickets, return trips too, even if it takes you till you're 56, she says. The flight attendant walks by, asking if anyone would like to purchase a beverage. My mother holds up her hand. What do you want? She asks me, and I say tomato juice. And I'll have a gin and tonic, she tells the flight attendant. Really? I'm impressed. I didn't know my mother drank gin. She sighs. Desperate times call for desperate measures, Theo. Then she looks up at me, her brow wrinkled in thought. When was the last time you and I were alone like this? I say, never? Huh, my mother says, considering this. The flight attendant returns with our drinks. Here you go, she chirps. You two getting off in L.A. or continuing on to Hawaii? I wish, my mother says. And when she twists the bottle top of the gin, it makes a sighing sound. Don't we all? The flight attendant laughs, and she moves down the aisle. The page my mother has stopped at in her magazine is a tourism spread of Hawaii, actually, or at least something equally tropical. Maybe we should just stay on the plane and go there, I say. She laughs. Squatter's rights. Sorry, sir. We're not vacating seats 15 A and B. By dinner time, we could be sitting on a beach. Getting tan, my mother muses. Drinking pina coladas, I suggest. My mother raises a brow. Virgin for you. There's a pause, as we both imagine a life that will never be ours. Maybe, I say after another moment, we should bring Jacob along. He loves coconut. This will never happen. My brother won't get on a plane. He'd have the mother of all meltdowns before that happened. And you can't exactly row a boat to Hawaii, not to mention the fact that we are categorically broke. But still. My mother lays her head on my shoulder. It feels weird, like I'm the one taking care of her instead of the other way around. Already, though, I'm taller than her and still growing. Let's do that. My mother agrees, as if we have a prayer.
Jacob. I have a joke. Two muffins are in an oven. One muffin says, "Wow, it's really hot in here." The other one jumps and says, "Yikes, a talking muffin." This is funny because, one, muffins don't talk. Two, I'm sane enough to know that, in spite of what my mother and Oliver and practically every psychiatrist in Vermont seem to think, I have never struck up a conversation with a muffin in my entire life. Three, that would be just plain corny. Four, you got that joke too, right? My mother said that she would be talking to Dr. Newcomb for a half hour. Yet it has been 42 minutes, and she still hasn't come back into the waiting room. We're here because Oliver said we have to be. Even though he managed to get all those concessions at court for me, and even though all of those help improve his insanity defense to the jury, although, don't ask me how, insanity is not equivalent to disability or even quirkiness, apparently, we also have to meet with a shrink he's found, whose job it will be to tell the jury that they should let me go because I have Asperger's. Finally, when it's been 16 minutes longer than my mother said it would be, when I've started to sweat a little and my mouth has gone dry because I'm thinking maybe my mother forgot about me, and I'll be stuck in this little waiting room forever, Dr. Newcomb opens the door. "Jacob," she says, smiling, "why don't you come in?" She's a very tall woman, with an even taller tower of hair, and skin as smooth and rich as dark chocolate. Her teeth gleam like headlights, and I find myself staring at them. My mother is nowhere in the room. I feel a hum rise in my throat. "Where's my mom?" I ask. "She said she'd be back in a half hour, and now it's 47 minutes. "We took a little longer than I expected. Your mom went out the back way and is waiting for you just outside," Dr. Newcomb says, as if she can read my mind. "Now, Jacob, I've had a lovely talk with your mom and Dr. Morano." She sits down and offers me the seat across from her. It's upholstered in zebra stripes, which I don't really like. Patterns in general make me uneasy. Every time I look at a zebra, I can't figure out whether it's black with white stripes or white with black stripes, and that frustrates me. "It's my job to examine you," Dr. Newcomb says. "I have to give a report back to the court so that what you say here isn't confidential. Do you understand what that means?" "Intended to be kept secret," I say, rattling off the definition and frowning. "But you're a doctor." "Yes, a psychiatrist just like Dr. Morano." "Then what I tell you is privileged," I say. "There's doctor-patient confidentiality." "No, this is a special circumstance where I'm going to tell people what you say because of the court case." This whole procedure is starting to sound even worse. Not only do I have to speak to a psychiatrist I don't know, but she plans to blab about the session. "Then I'd rather talk to Dr. Moon. She doesn't tell anyone my secrets." "I'm afraid that's not an option," Dr. Newcomb says. And then she looks at me. "Do you have secrets?" "Everyone has secrets." "Does having secrets sometimes make you feel bad?" I sit very upright on the chair, so that my back doesn't have to touch the crazy zigzagged fabric. "Sometimes, I guess." She crosses her legs. They're really long, like a giraffe's. Giraffes and zebras. And I am the elephant who can't forget. "Do you understand that what you did, Jacob, was wrong in the eyes of the law?" "The law doesn't have eyes," I tell her. "It has courts and judges and witnesses and juries, but no eyes. I wonder where Oliver dug this one up. I mean, honestly." "Do you understand that what you did was wrong?" I shake my head. "I did the right thing." "Why was it right?" "I was following the rules." "What rules?" I could tell her more, but she's going to tell other people, and that means I won't be the only one who gets into trouble. But I know she wants me to explain. I can tell by the way she leans forward. I shrink back in the chair. It means touching the zebra print, but it's the lesser of two evils. "I see dead people!" Dr. Newcomb just stares at me. "It's from The Sixth Sense," I tell her. "Yes, I know," she says, and she tilts her head. "Do you believe in God, Jacob?" "We don't go to church. My mom says religion is the root of all evil." "I didn't ask what your mom thinks about religion. I asked what you think about it." "I don't think about it." "Those rules you mentioned," Dr. Newcomb says. "Didn't we get off this topic?" "Do you know that there's a rule against killing people?" "Yes." "Well," Dr. Newcomb asks, "do you think it would be wrong to kill somebody?" "Of course I do, but I can't say that. I can't say it because to admit to this rule would break another one." I stand up and start walking, bouncing up and down on my toes because sometimes it helps me jog the rest of my brain and body into sync. But I don't answer. Dr. Newcomb isn't giving up, though. "When you were at Jess's house on the day she died, did you understand that it's wrong to kill somebody?" "I'm not bad," I quote. "I'm just drawn that way." I really need you to answer the question, Jacob. On the day that you were at Jess's house, did you feel like you were doing something wrong? No, I say immediately. I was following the rules. Why did you move Jess's body? She asks. I was setting up a crime scene. Why did you clean up the evidence at the house? Because we're supposed to clean up our messes. Dr. Newcomb writes something down. You had a fight with Jess during your tutoring session a couple of days before she died, right? Yes. What did she say to you that day? Just get lost. But you went to her house on Tuesday afternoon anyway. I nod. Yes, we had an appointment. Jess was obviously upset with you. Why did you go back? People are always saying things that aren't true. I shrug. Like when Theo tells me to get a grip, it doesn't mean hold something, it means calm down. I assume Jess was doing the same kind of thing. What were your reactions to the victim's responses? I shake my head. I don't know what you're talking about. When you got to Jess's house, did you yell at her? At one point, I had leaned right down into her face and screamed at her to wake up. Yes, I say. But she didn't answer me. Do you understand that Jess is never coming back? Of course I understand that. I could probably tell Dr. Newcomb a thing or two about body decomposition. Yeah. Do you think Jess was scared that day? I don't know. How do you think you would have felt if you were the victim? For a moment, I consider this. Dead, I say.
This ends Disc 12. House Rules, Disc 13.
Oliver. 3 weeks before we go to trial, we start jury selection. You would think that, with autism being diagnosed at the rate it currently is, finding a jury of Jacob's peers, or at least parents who have children on the spectrum, would not be as difficult as it is. But the only two jurors with autistic children who are in our initial pool are the ones Helen uses her peremptory strikes against to get them removed. In between my stints in court, I received reports from Dr. Newcomb and Dr. Cohn, the two psychiatrists who've met with Jacob. Unsurprisingly, Dr. Cohn has found Jacob quite sane. The state's shrink would declare a toaster sane. And Dr. Newcomb has said that Jacob was legally insane at the time the crime was committed. Even so, Newcomb's report isn't going to be that much help. In it, Jacob comes off sounding like an automaton. The truth is, jurors might want to be fair, but their gut instinct about a defendant has a great deal to do with the verdict rendered, which means that I'd better stack the odds to make Jacob look as sympathetic as possible, since I have no intention of letting him actually testify. With his flat affect, his darting eyes, his nervous tics, well, that would just be a disaster. A week before the trial begins, I turn my attention to getting Jacob ready for court. When I reach the Hunt household, Thor bolts out of the car and runs to the porch, his tail wagging. He's gotten pretty attached to Theo, to the point where I sometimes wonder if I ought to just leave him curled up on the kid's bed overnight, since he seems to have taken up residence there anyway. And God knows Theo needs the company. In the wake of his cross-country journey, he's been grounded until he's 30. Although I keep telling him that I can probably find a reason to appeal. I knock, but no one answers the door. I've gotten used to letting myself inside, though, so I walk in and watch Thor trot upstairs. Hello, I call out, and Emma steps forward with a smile. You're just in time, she says. For what? Jacob got 100 on a math test, and as a reward, I'm letting him set up a crime scene. That's macabre. Just another day in my life, she says. Ready, Jacob calls from upstairs. I follow Emma, but instead of heading to Jacob's room, we continue on to the bathroom. When she pushes open the door, I gag, my hand pressed against my mouth. What is this? I manage. There is blood everywhere. It's like I've stepped into the lair of a serial killer. One long line of blood arcs horizontally across the white shell of the shower wall. Facing that, on the mirror, are a series of drops in various elongated shapes. Even more strange, Emma doesn't seem to be the least bit upset that the walls of the shower and the mirror and sink are completely drenched with blood. She takes one look at my face and starts laughing. Relax, Oliver, she says. It's just corn syrup. She reaches over the mirror, dabs her finger to the mess, and holds it up to my lips. I can't resist the urge to taste her. And yeah, it is corn syrup. With red dye, I'm guessing. Way to contaminate a crime scene, Mom, Jacob mutters. So you remember that the tail of the blood stain usually points in the direction the blood was traveling. All of a sudden, I can see Jess Ogilvy standing in the shower, and Jacob across from her, standing right where Emma is. I'll give you a hint, Jacob tells Emma. The victim was right here. He points to the bath mat between the shower stall and the mirror over the sink. I can easily picture Jacob with a bleach solution, wiping down the mirror and the tub at Jess Ogilvy's place. Why the bathroom? I ask. What made you choose to set your crime scene here, Jacob? Those words are all it takes to make Emma understand why I'm so shaken. Oh, God, she says, turning. I didn't realize. Blood spatter's messy, Jacob says, confounded. I thought my mom would be less likely to yell at me if I did it in the bathroom. A line from Dr. Newcomb's report jumps out at me. I was following the rules. Clean it up, I announce, and I walk out. New rules, I say, when the three of us are sitting at the kitchen table. First and foremost, no more crime scene staging. Why not? Jacob demands. You tell me, Jake. You're on trial for homicide. You think it's smart to create a fake murder a week before your trial? You don't know what neighbors are peeking through your curtains. A, our neighbors are too far to see through the windows, and B, that crime scene upstairs was nothing like what was at Jess's house. This one showed the arterial bleed in the shower and also the cast-off pattern of blood flung from the knife that killed the victim behind her, on the mirror. At Jess's, I don't want to hear it, I interrupt, covering my ears. Every time I think I have a chance to save Jacob's ass, he does something like this. Unfortunately, I waver between thinking that behavior like what I've just witnessed proves my case. How could he not be considered insane? And thinking that it's chillingly off-putting to a jury. After all, Jacob's not talking to imaginary giant rabbits. He's pretending to kill someone. That looks pretty fucking deliberate to me. That looks like practice, so that in reality, he might get it perfect. Rule number two, you need to do exactly what I tell you in court. I've been to court like 10 times now, Jacob says. I think I can figure it out. Emma shakes her head. Listen to him, she says quietly. Right now, Oliver's the boss. I'm going to give you a stack of post-its every time we walk into that courtroom, I tell him. If you need a break, you hand me a note. What kind of note? Jacob says. Any note. But you only do it if you need a break. I'm also going to give you a pad and pen, and I want you to write stuff down, just like you would if you were watching Crime Busters. But there's nothing interesting going on in that courtroom. Jacob, I tell him flatly, your life is being decided in there. Rule number three, you can't talk to anyone, not even your mother. And you, I say, turning to Emma, cannot tell him how he's supposed to feel or react or what he should look like or how he should act. Everything you two pass back and forth is going to be read by the prosecution and the judge. I don't even want you two discussing the weather because they're going to interpret it. And if you do anything suspicious, you're going to be kicked off that council table. You want to write, breathe? That's fine. Or, it's okay, don't worry. But that's as specific as I want you to get. Emma touches Jacob's arm. You understand? Yes, he says. Can I go now? Do you have any idea how hard it is to get corn syrup off a wall once it dries? I completely ignore him. Rule number 4, you will wear a button-down shirt and a tie. And I don't want to hear that you haven't got the money for it, because this isn't negotiable, Emma. No buttons, Jacob announces in a tone that brooks no argument. Why not? Because they feel weird on my chest. All right, I say. How about a turtleneck? Can't I wear my lucky green sweatshirt? Jacob asks. I wore it when I took my SATs, and I got 800 on the math section. Why don't we go up to your closet and find something? Emma suggests, and we all trudge upstairs again, this time to Jacob's room. I studiously avoid looking into the bathroom as we pass. Although the police still have his fuming chamber as evidence, Jacob has configured a new one, an overturned planter. It's not transparent like his fish tank, but it must be getting the job done, because I can smell the glue. Emma throws open the closet door. If I hadn't seen it with my own eyes, I would never have believed it. Chromatically ordered, Jacob's clothes hang side by side, not quite touching. There are jeans and chinos in the blue area, and a rainbow of long and short-sleeved tees. And yes, in its correct sequence, the lucky green sweatshirt. It looks like a gay pride shrine in there. There is a fine line between looking insane in court and looking disrespectful. I take a deep breath, wondering how to explain this to a client who cannot think beyond the feeling of a placket of buttons on his skin. Jacob, I say, you have to wear a shirt with a collar, and you have to wear a tie. I'm sorry, but none of this will work. What does the way I look have to do with telling the jury the truth? Because they still see you, I answer. So you need to make a good first impression. He turns away. They're not going to like me anyway. Nobody ever does. He doesn't say this in a way that suggests he feels sorry for himself. More like he's just telling me a fact, relating the way the world works. After Jacob leaves to clean up his mess, I remember that Emma's in the room with me. The bathroom, I don't know what to say. She sinks down onto Jacob's bed. He does this all the time. Sets up scenes for me to solve. It's what makes him happy. Well, there's a big difference between using a bottle of corn syrup to get your jollies and using a human being. I don't need the jury to be wondering how far a leap there is from one to the other. Are you nervous? She asks, turning to face me. I nod. I probably shouldn't be admitting this to her, but I can't help it. Can I ask you something? Sure, I say. Anything. Do you believe he killed Jess? I already told you that doesn't matter to a jury. We're utilizing the defense most likely to— I'm not asking you as Jacob's lawyer, Emma interrupts. I'm asking you as my friend. I draw in my breath. I don't know. If he did, I don't believe it was intentional. She folds her arms. I just keep thinking that if we could get the police to reopen the case, to look harder at Jess's boyfriend. The police, I say, think they've found their murderer, based on the evidence. If they didn't, we wouldn't be going to court on Wednesday. The prosecutor thinks she's got enough proof to make a jury see things her way. But Emma, I'm going to do everything I can to keep that from happening. I have a confession to make, Emma says. When we saw Dr. Newcomb, I was supposed to meet with her for a half hour. I told Jacob that I'd be 30 minutes, and then I very intentionally kept talking for another 15. I wanted Jacob to get rattled because I was late. I wanted him stimming by the time he met with her, so that she'd be able to write about all that behavior in the court report. Emma's eyes are dark and hollow. What kind of mother does that? I look at her. One who's trying to save her son from going to prison. Emma shivers. She walks to the window, rubbing her arms, even though it's downright hot in the room. I'll find him a collared shirt, she promises. But you'll have to get it on him.
Case 9. Pajama Game. Early in the morning on February 17, 1970, the officers at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, responded to a call from Army Doctor Jeffrey McDonald. They arrived to find his pregnant wife, Colette, and two young daughters dead from multiple stab wounds. Colette had been stabbed 37 times with a knife and an ice pick, and McDonald's torn pajama top was draped on top of her. On the headboard of the bed, in blood, was the word pig. McDonald himself was found with minor wounds beside his wife. He said he'd been hurt by three males and a woman in a white hat who chanted, "Acid is groovy, kill the pigs." When the men attacked him, McDonald said that he pulled his pajama top over his head and used it to block the jabs of the ice pick. Eventually, he said, he was knocked unconscious. The Army didn't believe McDonald. The living room, for example, didn't show signs of a struggle except for an overturned table and plant. Fibers from the torn pajama top were not found in the room where it was torn, but rather in the bedrooms of his daughters. They theorized that McDonald killed his wife and daughters and tried to cover up the murders by using articles about the Manson family in a magazine that was found in the living room. The Army dropped the case because of the poor quality of the investigative techniques, and McDonald was honorably discharged. In 1979, McDonald was tried in a civilian court. A forensic scientist testified that the doctor's pajama top, which he said had been used to block his attackers, had 48 clean, cylindrical holes that were too tidy for a violent attack. To make a hole that shape, the top would have had to be immobile, something that was very unlikely if McDonald was defending himself from someone trying to stab him. The scientist also showed how, by folding the top a certain way, those 48 holes could have been created by 21 jabs, the exact number of times Colette McDonald had been stabbed with an ice pick. The holes lined up with the pattern of her wounds, indicating that the pajama top had been placed on her before she was stabbed and not used in self-defense by McDonald. He was sentenced to life in prison for three murders and still maintains that he is innocent.
Chapter 9. Theo. It isn't the first time I wrestled my brother into a coat and tie. "Jesus, Jacob, cut it out before you give me a black eye," I mutter, holding his hands pinned over his head and straddling his body, which twists like a fish that suddenly found itself on a dock. My mother is working her hardest to make a knot in his tie, but Jacob's thrashing so much that it's practically a noose. "Do you really need to button it?" I yell. But I doubt she can hear me. Jacob's got us beat in sheer decibels. I bet the neighbors can hear him, and I wonder what they think. Probably that we're sticking pins in his eyeballs. My mother manages to fasten one of the tiny buttons on the Oxford shirt collar before Jacob bites her hand. She makes a little squeak and jerks her fingers away from his neck, leaving one of the buttons still unfastened. "That's good enough," she says, just as Oliver arrives to pick us all up for the first day of the trial. "I knocked," he says, but obviously we wouldn't have heard him downstairs. "You're early," my mother answers. She's still wearing a bathrobe. "Well, let's see the finished product," Oliver says, and my mom and I both step away from Jacob. Oliver looks at him for one long moment. "What the hell is this?" he asks. Okay, I'll admit Jacob's not going to win any fashion awards, but he's in a coat and tie, which were the criteria. He's wearing a polyester suit the color of an egg yolk that my mother found at a thrift store, a pale yellow shirt with a stretchy golden knit tie. "He looks like a pimp," Oliver says. My mother presses her lips together. "It's Yellow Wednesday." "I don't care if it's Polka Dot Sunday," Oliver says, "and neither does anyone on that jury. That's the kind of suit Elton John wears to a gig, Emma, not what a defendant wears to trial." "It was a compromise," my mother insists. Oliver runs a hand down his face. Didn't we talk about a blue blazer? Fridays are blue days, Jacob says. I'm wearing one then. And coincidentally, you are also wearing it today, Oliver replies. He glances at me. I want you to help me while your mother goes and gets dressed. But, Emma, I don't have time to fight with you right now, Oliver tells her. My mother is planning to wear a very simple dark gray skirt with a blue sweater. I was here when Oliver went through her entire closet, channeling his inner Heidi Klum, and picked out what he said would be dark and conservative. Angry, my mother huffs out of Jacob's room. I fold my arms. I just got him into those clothes. No way I'm getting him out of them. Oliver shrugs. Jacob, take that off. Gladly, Jacob explodes, and he rips the clothes off his own body in seconds flat. Oliver tackles him. Get the pinstriped shirt and the blazer and the red tie, he orders, squinting into Jacob's open closet. The second I do, Jacob takes one look at the clothing, styles he hates, plus they're the wrong color, and lets out a blood-curdling scream. Holy shit, Oliver murmurs. I reach for Jacob's hands and pin them over his head again. You ain't seen nothing yet, I say. The last time I had to dress my brother in a coat and tie, we were headed to my grandfather's funeral. My mother wasn't herself that day, which is maybe why Jacob didn't put up as big a fight about the clothes as he did today. Neither of us owned a coat and tie, so my mother had borrowed them from a neighbor's husband. We were younger then, and a man's jacket fit neither of us. We sat on the side of the viewing room where the coffin was with our clothes swimming on us, as if we'd been bigger before our grief hit. In reality, I didn't know my grandfather very well. He'd been in a nursing home since my grandmother died, and my mom dragged us to visit him twice a year. It smelled like pee, and I used to get totally creeped out by the old people in their wheelchairs, whose skin seemed stretched too shiny and tight over bony knuckles and knees. The one good memory I had of my grandfather involved sitting on his lap when I was really little and having him pull a quarter out of my ear. His breath smelled like whiskey, and his white hair, when I touched it, was stiff as a Brillo pad. But still, he was dead, and I thought I should feel something. Because if I didn't, that meant I was no better than Jacob. My mother had, for the most part, left us to our own devices while she accepted the condolences of people whose names she didn't even know. I sat next to Jacob, who was staring straight ahead at the casket. It was black and propped up on fancy sawhorses that were covered with red velvet drapes. Jacob, I whispered, what do you think happens after? After what? After, you know, you die. Do you think you still get to go to heaven, even if you never went to church? I thought about this for a moment. Do you think that you recognize people in heaven? Or is it like moving to a new school and starting over? Jacob looked at me. After you die, you decompose. Coliforidae arrive on a body within minutes of death. The blowflies lay eggs in open wounds or natural orifices even before death, and their larvae hatch out in 24 hours. So even though maggots can't live underground, the pupal cases might be buried alive with the corpse and do their work from inside the coffin. My jaw dropped. What? Jacob challenged. Did you really think embalming lasted forever? After that, I didn't ask him any more questions. Once Jacob had been forced into his new formal wear, I leave Oliver to deal with the fallout and go to my mother's bedroom. She doesn't answer when I knock, so I push the door open a little bit and peek inside. In here, she calls from her closet.
Mom, I say, and I sit down on her bed. Is Jacob dressed? She pokes her head around the doorframe. Pretty much. I pick at a thread on her quilt. In all the years we've lived here, my mother has slept on the left side of the bed. You'd think by now she would have branched out and taken over the whole damn thing. But no. It's like she's still waiting for someone to crawl into the other side. Mom, I repeat, I have to talk to you. Sure, baby, shoot, she says, and then, where the hell are my black heels? It's sort of important. It's about Jacob. She steps out of the closet and sits down beside me on the bed. Oh, Theo, she sighs. I'm scared, too. It's not that. We're going to do this the way we've done everything when it comes to Jacob, she promises. Together. She gives me a tight squeeze, which only makes me feel more miserable, because I know I'm not going to say what I want to say to her, what I need to say. How do I look? She asks, drawing away from me. For the first time, I notice what she's wearing. Not the conservative skirt and blue sweater and pearls that Oliver picked out for her, but instead, a totally out-of-season, bright yellow sundress. She grins at me. It's Yellow Wednesday, she says.
Jacob. The first job from which I was fired was a pet store. I won't give the name of the chain because I'm not sure if that's printable, and I have enough legal trouble to last me a lifetime right now. However, I will say, objectively, that I was the best employee they had, and that, in spite of this, they still dismissed me. Even though when someone bought a corgi puppy, I offered facts along with puppy chow. It's related to the dachshund. Its name is Welsh and means dwarf dog. Even though I didn't steal from the cash register like one of my coworkers. Even though I didn't tell on that coworker. Even though I wasn't rude to customers and never bitched when it was my turn to clean the public restrooms. What my boss, Alan, who was 19 and an extremely viable candidate for Proactive, told me was that customers had complained because of my appearance. No, I didn't have snot running down my face. I wasn't drooling. I didn't wear my pants halfway to my knees like the coworker I referenced above. All I did, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, was refuse to wear the store uniform. It was a blue button-down shirt. I wore it on Fridays, but honestly, it was bad enough I had to deal with buttons. Was I supposed to put up with wearing colors on their off days, too? No one had complained, by the way. And it was easy to spot me as an employee because, even when I wasn't wearing the uniform, I still wore a tag as big as a newborn's head that read, "Hello, my name is Jacob. Can I help you?" The real reason I was fired was that, after several weeks of making excuses to Alan about why my uniform did not appear on my body unless I happened to be scheduled to work on a Friday, I finally told him that I was autistic and that I had a thing about clothing colors, not to mention buttons. So, in spite of the fact that the puppies genuinely loved me and that I sold more of them than any other person working here, in spite of the fact that even at the moment I was fired, one of the employees was texting her boyfriend instead of ringing up a customer, and another was flirting with Steve in amphibians. In spite of all these things, I was made a scapegoat because of my disability. Yeah, I'm playing the Asperger's card. All I know is that before I told Alan I had AS, he was willing to make excuses along with me. And afterward, he just wanted me gone. This is the story of my life. We ride to the courthouse in Oliver's car. My mother is in the front seat, and Theo and I are in the back. I spend most of the trip looking at the things I took for granted, sights I hadn't seen while I was cooped up under house arrest. The Colony Diner, with its busted neon sign advertising, "Eat at the Colon." The picture window of the pet store where I used to work, with a Gordian knot of puppies on view. The movie theater where I lost my first tooth, and the cross on the side of the road where a teenager once died en route to school during an ice storm. The Restwood Bible Church billboard that reads, "Free coffee, eternal life. Membership has its privileges." "Okay," Oliver says, after he pulls into the parking spot and turns off the ignition. "Here we go." I open my door and step out of the car, and suddenly there are 1,000 sounds hitting me like arrows, and so much light that everything goes white. I can't hold my hands up to my eyes and my ears at the same time, and somewhere in between the screaming I can hear my name and my mother's voice in Oliver's. They multiply before my eyes, microphones like cancer cells, and they're coming closer. Oliver. Shit, I should have thought of this. Mom. Jacob, close your eyes, baby. Can you hear me?